Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
So let's talk a little bit about Tesla. At its highs today, shares were up about 1.6%, stuck pretty much unchanged on the day. But there was a flurry of news on the company.
That's too bad. That's one of my decliners.
Sorry. No, okay. It's up 0.04%. You can always hope. We still have, about a half an hour to go.
Never count on Tesla.
All right. So among the stories on Tesla and Elon, Tesla deliveries sliding. Bill Ackman telling CNBC today he would be interested in a deal to take Elon Musk's X Corp public, but he says he hasn't talked to Elon yet. And then there's, you know, maybe he wasn't watching the Jet Chiefs game and looking out for Taylor Swift. Maybe he was doing something else last night, Tim.
He live streamed himself playing through Diablo dungeon late last night. It's a test of his social network's ability to handle game streaming. Did it go better than his visit to the border last week?
Good question. All right, so what does it all mean for the company and the priorities of its ever-evolving and news-generating leader? With that, we turn to Bloomberg News EV reporter Sean O'Kane on the phone out there in Austin, Texas, and then right here in our Interactive Broker studio, Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin. Let's get to the kind of news, and that is the Tesla deliveries. Sean, what can you tell us about the news? And I thought Tesla had telegraphed a lot of this.
They had. I think the question was really just, you know, how big of a slowdown were they going to encounter? And I think, you know, we really saw that impact today. They did a pretty big changeover in China by getting that facility ready to produce what is not a dramatically new version of the Model 3, but certainly something that that required some downtime to get new tooling in. And they've also had some downtime here in Austin as they have been getting things ready to start production of the Cybertruck. So, you know, I think you're right, they telegraphed it. I think it was just a little bit of a surprise to Wall Street, maybe not to Tesla, how much of a miss it was.
Sean, you said Cybertruck, so I got to ask you about the Cybertruck.
Sure.
This thing was unveiled years ago. Is it actually going to start production in the fourth quarter this year?
You never know with Tesla, right? But yeah, I think we're probably going to see some limited production. I mean, even Elon Musk has said that they're not going to be in volume production for this thing until next year at some point. But we're seeing a lot of signs that they're actually getting close to that. There are some, you know, people who follow the company really closely, investors or fans who have been flying drones over the factory here in Austin, who have seen some crash-tested Cybertrucks. We've seen some sort of, you know, what they call release candidates, which is pretty close to production quality, driving out in the wild. So that they're doing crash tests is a pretty good sign that they feel comfortable with the level that they're at, and they're ready to start maybe shipping some of them soon, even if they are missing the third quarter target that they, the most recent deadline they had given themselves.
All right, not to shame on toddlers, but sometimes it feels like watching Elon is like watching a toddler. He's like kind of all over the place. So Max Chafkin, come on in on here. We've got, you know, the delivery news. We've got Bill Ackman out there on CNBC, maybe, I don't know, regarding X. And then you've got Elon Musk late last night streaming. How do you think about him?
Well, so I am not a Diablo expert. All I can say is that, you know, for months, Twitter, now the company now known as X, has been, you know, trying to find ways to justify itself, trying to find ways to essentially turn the company around, turn perceptions about the company around, both among advertisers and users. And I think that is the most important asset that the company has is Elon Musk and Elon Musk's own feed. And so logging on to X to live stream a video game, as he did the other night, or going to the border in Texas, as he did on, I believe it was on Friday, and sort of trying to, you know, do kind of like a weird political magazine thing. It's all about just finding ways to change the narrative here. I don't think it's totally clear that it's working, although the company definitely wants to. We have Linda Yaccarino set to meet with bankers later in the week, and of course, this kind of long-running question about how long it's going to take for advertisers to sort of come back in big numbers.
But Max, is there any indication that he's built a viable business now that he's let so many people go and changed the product so much since he took it private?
Well, I think it's possible. You know, the other day...
Like, are we putting the cart before the horse here with talking about taking this company public?
The most important asset that, as I said, you know, the most important asset this company has is Elon Musk's following. As we know, you know, Elon Musk is amazing at getting public market investors to put money into speculative investments. Here we are talking about the Cybertruck, this thing that, as you said, is years delayed. And investors are still sort of, you know, okay with it. So from Bill Ackman's point of view, from Ackman, of course, is basically has this investment vehicle that's a lot like an IPO. He needs a candidate company. Mm-hmm. If he were somehow able to persuade Elon Musk to, you know, work with him on a Spark deal, it's called a Spark. It's basically a lot like an IPO or somewhere between an IPO and a SPAC. And if you were able to persuade Elon Musk to stay as CEO, that would probably, you know, go over well with public market shareholders. There still are a lot of fans of Elon Musk
again,
at the moment.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, Sean, I do wonder, too, in terms of there's always, I feel like when we talk about Elon, that he's got his hands in too many pots, although he seems to do well with it. But there is always that point when there's maybe some concerns. It's like, well, wait a minute. Maybe he's just doing too much. What are investors, you know, thinking about how Tesla kind of longer term in terms of where it's going? Is it still on track?
I mean, I think there's always questions from some investors about succession planning and sort of the roadmap. You know, I think it'll be really interesting to see if those questions resurface in any sort of tangible way on this call later this month as they discuss the third quarter results, because this is going to be the first one since we find out that that the CFO, Zach Kirkhorn, is leaving. And that's one of the big sort of questions hanging over the company right now and over the last couple of weeks is what are the circumstances of that departure? Zach is someone who was making promises that, you know, gross margins were going to stay at a certain level and that, you know, all the price cuts earlier this year really weren't going to eat into the business. And then that wound up actually not being exactly the case. And then a couple months later, he's out saying he's out the door. So I think there are, you know, maybe more than recently over the last couple months or year or so, we're probably going to hear more of those questions about it. But, you know, broadly, I don't think we see too much doubt in the outlook for them, because they the stock still sort of holds, and they've been able to deliver the vehicles that they have on the road in pretty sizable numbers.
Right,
especially
stock
compared
still
to
has
any
doubled
of the
this year. Yeah.
Hey, Sean, give me like 30 seconds on the Cybertruck here, because this thing is really important for Tesla, and it's entering a market that's dominated by Ford and GM that, you know, Japanese automakers have tried to enter and dominate, and they've failed.
It's really a great unknown. I mean, there clearly seems to be a lot of interest. How much of that is just people liking to joke about how they have a pre-order in for it or not is kind of hard to tell.
Yeah.
But there's so much that we don't know about it. We don't really know the final base price, because that's obviously going to be going up by the company's own admission. We don't know, you know, how well it's going to perform in these crash tests. Steel is pretty heavy and pretty rigid compared to the cars that we're used to these days that crumple up pretty easily to be able to displace all that energy. I'm sure Elon Musk would say, hey, look, we've got autopilot and maybe full self-driving down the road. we're not going to need that. But you know, I think there's just a lot we need to know. And that's one of the reasons that this delivery event, whenever it happens, is going to be so key to watch. How much more information do we get?
Got about 35
seconds left. Yeah, and there's also the question of demand. I mean, you know, going back 6 months or so, we were talking a lot about are Tesla buyers getting tired of Elon's antics? Is there demand for these things? Price cuts, these massive price cuts on the Model 3 and Model Y in particular, have clearly helped address that problem, if it even was a problem. But the Cybertruck presents, you know, a new challenge, right? This is a very, very different looking car, a very different car from what the average truck buyer is into. And it's not clear that the, you know, combination of video games and weighing in on immigration policy is necessarily the best way to reach, you know, the average truck buyer.
But it's pretty normal if you're Elon.
Definitely the best way to reach an Elon fan.
All right, got to leave it there. Our thanks to Sean O'Kane, Bloomberg News EV reporter, and of course, Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Jafkin.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Businessweek podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, so Tim, we've been talking a lot about this conversation that Jamie Dimon had with Bloomberg Originals' Emily Chang, that over the next generation, AI, artificial intelligence, is going to have a profound impact, not just on the way we work, but also in a big way on our health.
Yeah, here's what he said. Your children are going to live to 100 and not have cancer because of technology. And literally, they'll probably be working 3.5 days a week. Live to 100? A world without cancer? 3.5 day work weeks?
Sign me up.
Yeah, sounds pretty great, right?
All right, so let's see what our next guest has to say about the role AI will play in our health. Michael Dowling, back with us, president and CEO at Northwell Health. You know, the largest healthcare provider in New York, the Northwell System, treating over 2 million New Yorkers each year at 21 hospitals, 890 outpatient facilities. Michael Dowling joining us on the phone from Long Island this afternoon. Michael, it is great to be talking with you and not necessarily focused on the pandemic. So nice to be back with you once again. AI, you guys are hosting your annual Constellations Forum that focuses on AI and healthcare, Constellation Forum, I should say. And you are focusing on AI and healthcare. How are you guys, in putting this together, thinking about artificial intelligence, which is not a new science? You're actually on Zoom, so good to see you on camera.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I mean, as you just mentioned, AI is not new. The capability of it, the accelerated capability of it, has been enhanced dramatically over the last couple of years, and that will continue. And it's going to be an integral part of everything that we do going forward. So we have to decide, the big decision point for me is deciding what is it good for and what is it not so good for. And I think we will be going through that analysis for quite a time, because it provides extraordinary opportunity to improve clinical care, improve diagnosis, analyze data. But it also brings with it some potential dangers. You don't want the machine brain to outpace the human brain so that the human brain can't figure out what the machine brain is doing to you.
Hmm. Okay.
That is something we have to be very, very careful of.
Let's talk about the pluses before we get into the you know, potential dark side here, which sounds like, you know, something out of a sci-fi movie. What do you make of what Jamie Dimon said earlier today? Your children are going to live to 100 and not have cancer because of AI technology. Is that true?
Well, I want to live to be 100 first.
That's what we were talking about earlier.
Me too.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
But is that where we are? Is that an accurate thing to say, do you think?
We're getting awfully close.
I think we just got to be careful not to over-exaggerate. I think it can have wonderful potential to allow us to identify the diseases earlier on, especially with the genome sequencing. When you combine the results of the mapping of the human genome with AI, we will be able to predetermine way in advance what you potentially could end up with having problems with.
Okay, so then what would you do about that?
Potentially able to intervene.
What would you do about that if you noticed somebody was set to get cancer?
Well, then I think that you've got to determine, the clinical leadership has to determine how you intervene, how you change behavior so people act differently, what kind of clinical treatments that you have to engage in to allow people to live longer. Remember, in the last 50 years or 60 years, we've added about 30 years to life. Wow. The average life expectancy back in the 1930s was around 47 to 50. Today, we're in the 70s and 80s. So we've had major progress.
I do want to push back on this a little bit, because in recent years, we've also seen it come down as a result of COVID and drug overdoses.
Yeah, but that's a temporary thing. I mean, that happens. You look at the long-term trend, not the short-term, burps in a statistic. It's the long-term trend. And sure, when you have a thing like COVID, there is increase in mortality, and it does come down a little bit. But I don't think that's something that will set a prediction for the future.
What do you believe will be the most significant changes in healthcare that helps patients live longer and live a better, longer life? Watching aging parents or grandparents, it isn't always pretty and it's often very difficult. So I would live to 200 as long as I know I'm healthy and I can get around.
And some of your friends were living to 200 too.
That would be kind. Yeah, how are you thinking about that?
The biggest change, in my view, to make those results a reality, it goes beyond the delivery of medical care. It has to do with lifestyle and behavior, so all of the social determinants of health. It has to deal with some of the societal issues. I mean, we do a great job of taking care of you after you get sick, but we have to do a much better job of taking care of you before you get sick so you can prolong life. But that involves finding ways to get people to improve their own health,
but Michael,
improve their own lifestyle. And this is where AI can also be very, very helpful, because to be able to do the analytics,
right,
to be able to tell you what people should be doing to improve their own situations and not dependent upon others all the time.
Well, go back to that idea of genetic mapping, and, you know, we're born, we get a map, and we can already see what might be the potential problems. Maybe it's heart problems. So then maybe we know from the get-go that we have an awareness. I think about kids who are born, you know, who have, you know, diabetes from a young age, or different issues, if you will, you know, from a young age, that's their life, and they grow into or grow with that problem, and just from the get-go, look at life differently in terms of what they eat and what they need to do. And I do wonder if we have that map from the get-go, whether it's removing organs, treating things differently, like I just wonder, can we do it better at a much earlier stage?
Absolutely. I think that you'll be doing genome sequencing of all kids within a couple of years in most children's hospitals. We are investigating that possibility right now here at Northwell as part of our children's hospital. So I think that that's where it will start, mostly with children. Mm-hmm. And then I think it will expand to be doing genome sequencing with adults. But let's be cautious here, because while it offers wonderful, wonderful potential, we don't fully know all of the implications yet, and we don't fully understand all of the ethical issues involved. So, you know, you find out something about somebody or some family member, to what extent do you disclose it? To what extent do you share it? How should it be shared, and when should it be shared? All of these issues have to be worked out very, very carefully over the next couple of years. So the enormous potential is here with the combination of genome sequencing and AI, but I think we're going through a process over the next couple of years to figure out how to make use of it as appropriately as we possibly can, and not overreact,
right,
not underreact either, but not overreact. A little bit of caution is important here.
Especially given
the situations you've seen with ChatGPT recently, where it produces lots of controversial information that's not correct. You cannot be doing that in the healthcare sphere. It's just too dangerous.
But there's something kind of strange happening here, where we're talking about AI, Carol, mm-hmm. and what it can do in the future. Because, you know, there's this article in the current edition of Bloomberg Business Week about amoxicillin shortage here in the U.S. I mean, we're talking about a drug that was discovered more than 50 years ago. And I lived this nightmare on Friday, when my son was diagnosed with an ear infection, and the doctor had to spend a half hour of her time calling different pharmacies around Brooklyn, trying to find a 10-day supply of antibiotics, amoxicillin, that ended up costing me $3.16 when she finally found it. Michael, she wasted so much time doing this. How are we talking about a world where AI helps us live to 100, but we can't get amoxicillin?
Well, but that's why you've got to be, this is why you've got to be a little bit cautious, as I said. This is why you can't automatically assume that there's a new technology coming into play that is going to just solve everything immediately. There's a lot of other issues involved. I mean, one of the biggest changes in healthcare is moving more and more healthcare out into the community, expanding ambulatory care, moving stuff out of the hospital, be less hospital-centric, the whole supply chain issues, the whole labor cost issues. All of these things are all part of the complete package that you've got to deal with. There is no one magic, you know, cure-all just because you have a new technology. It's how we use that technology in the context of the whole environment that makes, if we do it right, we'll improve everything. But again, things are complicated. Healthcare is not a simple business. It's much more complex than other businesses. And you know, there is these days, there is, especially as a result of COVID, there's a growing mistrust of science.
Got it.
We gotta rebuild that trust. Otherwise,
Michael,
and the discoveries won't occur.
We've got to run. Michael Dowling, of course, CEO at Northwell Health, joining us right here on Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So the pandemic pause on student loan payments that lasted for more than 3 years, it has come to an end. So, Tim, starting this month, 40 million people with outstanding student loan payments that collectively exceed more than $1.6 trillion, they're going to have to start repaying them.
There's a reason our markets guests keep talking about this affecting consumer spending. Well, Melissa Byrne is executive director of We the 45 Million. It's a nonprofit organization. It says it represents student loan borrowers here in the U.S. The group wants to cancel all student loan debt. Melissa joins us on Zoom from Washington, D.C. Melissa, good to have you with us. How are you?
I've been better. It's a sad day knowing that the loans are turned back on, but, you know, it goes.
I mean, did you expect this? We knew this was going to happen.
I mean, I guess I had faith in, you know, I probably was a little naive to think that once we got the president to do the loan relief back in August of 2022, that we would get that done and then we would have an ease into repayment for the remaining 20 million people. The right wing dark money groups going all in to kill loan relief was, you know, a kick in the gut. And then Kevin McCarthy basically saying, will crash the global economy if we don't do return to repayment. You know, it's a lot. And so, I think in both circumstances, it's people with loans who weren't seen as fully human.
Melissa, help me out here. And we talk about this a lot in the newsroom, and I've had individuals who come up to me and say, you took a loan out. You've got to repay it. And one individual in particular said, you know, I chose not to go to college because I saw, you know, my siblings and the debt that they took on. I took a different route, but I was concerned about repayment. You know, what do you say to that argument?
I think one thing that I say is that it is really terrible that back in the 80s, our governments, both at the state level and federal level, quit funding higher education. Mm-hmm. And they made a choice to move funding of it. If you're poor or working class or first generation college student, you have to choose between, you know, getting an education or going into debt. And, you know, that's not a fair situation. Like if you're 18 or 19, you don't have savings. And the idea that in our country that if your parents are wealthy, they get to give you tax-free, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay for your college. And if you don't come from that kind of family, your option is debt or no college, working three jobs.
Is the bigger issue, I mean, I took on student debt, you know, and my parents kicked in what they could and got an award from the school and then took on some debt and I paid back that college debt. The bigger issue, I think many would argue, is that the cost of higher education has just gotten out of control many times over, right? The rate of inflation, we've all done the stories. Is that the bigger issue?
Yeah, I mean, that's the part. When I first started working on this back in I think it was 2010. And I come at this from being a borrower, from being a first immersion college student. So I come at this as like an impacted person who's experienced this whole system and the shame that came from it. It took me a long time to get over my shame of having debt, that I thought we would win free college first, and then it would be a cleanup round to help the folks that are struggling. But because of the pandemic and the ability to do the pause and then try to do a cleanup after the pause via, you know, a first round of a very we want full cancellation, but we didn't, you know, whine and complain that we just got 10K or 20K. We were good, you know, we saw that it helps real people, the 20 million people, and that you don't say no and you don't complain when 20 million people have a chance to have a decent life.
So what's the solution here? Because the part that I have a trouble understanding is if we cancel all student loan debt, but we don't address the cost of college, then we're going to end up in the next generation with the same exact issue, and it could even be worse.
Right, which is why we need to have free public college. We need to fix the way graduate programs work. Right now, a lot of universities will offer these master's programs that are basically used to help fund the whole university.
What are some examples of that?
You know, for example, you'll see like these like random policy degree programs, or what you're seeing now on is a whole growth of they're called online program managers, which are these online master's programs at universities. So you'll see them in social work or other kinds of programs like that. So people are going into like 200 grand of debt to get this online degree. USC in California had a big scandal around this. And then the money from that goes into just the general funds, because it doesn't cost that much money to, you know, educate somebody online. And so I think that these are things to look for. And you look at what the administration did, I think it was last week, in terms of the gainful employment regulations, and to have that also apply to graduate schools. But I think it all goes back to a value. It's like, should people, when they hit 18 or whatever age they want an education, should it be paywalled? Whether you want to become a welder or you want to cure cancer, so you need to go from like undergrad to med school, like, should that be paywalled? And should we have it where we're subsidizing rich families through the 529 programs to save for their kids' college, but not making a path for kids that are working class or middle class to be able to go on and get that education, so they become like, you know, functional contributing members of society, whatever that education is. If it's getting the education because you want to work at a hospital and draw blood and do that aid work, you need
Melissa,
a year of
Melissa,
school.
We just have about a minute left here. If I could just pop in, because I'm curious. Many would argue that the top end of the income strata and the lower end, they're taken care of. Either families can afford it and they can do the college savings plans, or at the lower end, that's where schools provide, you know, often pay for a big bulk of the tuition. You're talking about the middle income, I'm assuming. Like, who are the 45 million that
you represent?
It's the middle
and lower. Yeah, it's the middle and the lower. I mean, you know, outside of Harvard and Yale and Princeton, folks who come from, you know, if you're going to a state school because there's been so much defunding, you're still going to mostly going to have some debt even if you're on Pell, because unfortunately Pell isn't pegged to the cost of college.
Yeah, it's a tricky situation. You know, and I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit, because there are those who say, listen, you know, how do you forgive when other people are paying back their loans? And I feel like Tim, many would argue that it gets to that bigger issue of just how expensive it's all become, even
state
schools. It does. Well,
not all jobs are created equal when you graduate.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a real issue, because there's this, you know, we're taught follow your passion, and oftentimes passions don't pay.
Right.
That's an issue. I mean, I could talk about this for 5 minutes.
But didn't President Obama get into this, like trying to get colleges to say, you come out with this degree,
yeah,
here's what you're likely to make with that kind of degree. Like, to give people some transparency to say, go ahead and study this.
Yeah, but a lot of these people graduated before Obama was president, who are still paying back student loan debt. I mean, people who graduated in 2002 are paying back student loan debt.
I would argue it's just gotten out of
way
control
worse, yeah,
in terms of how expensive it is, and making it almost impossible for many to pay back those loans in an easy way or manageable way. Melissa Byrne, Executive Director of We the 45 Million. As you can tell, it's a hot topic. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.
guns are certainly on the docket for the new U.S. Supreme Court. Opening up a new term today, Tim.
And the lawyers will certainly be involved also.
Yeah, all right. Well, the court, the nation's highest court, thinking about where its conservative revolution should go next. One federal appeals court already has lots of ideas.
In the next 9 months, an outsized share of the high court's biggest cases will come from the ultra-conservative 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Those far-reaching rulings are proving impossible for the Supreme Court to ignore. Cases involving federal regulatory power, guns, and probably abortion and social media regulation are going to test, Carol, just how far the Supreme Court's conservative majority wants to go in remaking the nation's legal landscape.
We're all watching closely. Greg Storrs, Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter, writes for Bloomberg Businessweek about the conservative Fifth Circuit and the key decisions that could come in the justices' next terms. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Also here, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, with us at Bloomberg headquarters. The story, by the way, in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek, out on newsstands later this week, but find this story also online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. I feel like the fourth quarter is a big one on so many different levels, Joel, but definitely for the nation's highest court.
So this is the beginning of a new term for the Supreme Court, and Greg has become indispensable in writing sort of these walk-ups and helping us make sense of these moments. Obviously, the Supreme Court has made a number of interesting and controversial and headline-making decisions within the last couple years. What he flagged heading into this one is that the Fifth Circuit is an area of the country that is basically an appellate court that has a lot of very conservative judges. And this term in particular has a number of cases that originate with that appellate court. So, Greg, what does it all mean, and help us make sense of it all?
Well, it means a number of things. It starts off with some big cases involving the power of federal regulatory agencies. There's a case that the court's going to be hearing tomorrow involving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's the entity that regulates things like mortgages and auto loans set up after the 2008 financial collapse. And then it's got cases involving guns and almost certainly abortion coming up later on in the term, and they're really going to shape how far the Supreme Court's going to go this term.
Okay, so the Fifth Circuit, talk to us about what they oversee and their jurisdiction, and also what makes this time so different.
Yeah, so this is a court that has 12 Republican-appointed judges and just 4 Democratic-appointed judges, and 6 of the Republican-appointed judges are Trump appointees. And the individual personalities on the court are also very distinctive and very outspoken. So just to name one, there's a judge named James Ho who, even while on the bench, has written that abortion is a moral tragedy and said that if there's too much money in politics, it's because there's too much government. And these conservative litigants, in many cases like the state of Texas, which is part of the Fifth Circuit, like to get their cases before this court because very, very often they get good results. And with a number of these cases this term, what has happened is that this circuit has struck down an administration policy or said that an administrative agency has to change the way it's doing something. And the Biden administration has gone to the Supreme Court saying, hey, the Fifth Circuit's gone too far. So it's kind of testing just how conservative the U.S. Supreme Court is.
Well, it sounds like it's a list that they will be dealing with some very, very important issues. It's hard to pick out like what's the most significant, but where shall we begin in terms of cases that you, as someone who's followed the U.S. Supreme Court, like really is kind of front and center and you're thinking about this one in a big way?
Well, certainly the gun case that they're going to hear arguments on November 7th is one that's going to get a lot of attention. This is a case involving whether somebody who is subject to a domestic violence restraining order still has his or her full Second Amendment rights. The Supreme Court back a year and a half ago in a case called Bruin said the way we test whether a gun restriction is constitutional is to look back into history and see if we can find a historic analog to the current restriction. And in this case, the Fifth Circuit said, you know, we looked back at 1789 and we didn't see any laws that restricted gun possession by somebody who has a domestic violence restraining order, and therefore the Second Amendment doesn't allow this sort of restriction. So this is going to be a real test of whether the Supreme Court's history test that it set up a couple years ago means what it seems like it means. And if it does, then that means it's going to be really hard to argue in favor of all these other gun restrictions around the country.
So what does that mean for the federal ban on bump stocks? If we're continuing with the firearms theme, what would this court potentially do in that context? And explain what bump stocks are, actually. I think a lot of people might remember them, I think, in the wake of the Las Vegas shooting years ago.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a Las Vegas shooting. Basically, it's a device that turns a semi-automatic weapon, which is legal, into a machine gun, which is illegal. And the question, this is actually a very different legal question than the case involving the domestic violence restraining orders. This is actually a question of administrative law, not a question of the Second Amendment. The question is whether the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms, when it banned those, and this actually was under the Trump administration, whether it had authority to do that. Essentially, what ATF did was to say that a bump stock is akin to a machine gun, which is illegal, and therefore we're going to say the bump stocks are illegal too. So this one actually goes to one of those questions of how much power do federal regulatory agencies do. It just happens to be one that also coincides with this big fight over gun rights.
Greg, let's bring it back to core Bloomberg competencies. Two other areas that will be of great interest: the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as well as the Securities Exchange Commission. What might be in the balance here?
Yeah, it's like barely a decade old, I think, the CFPB.
Yeah, just slightly more than that. You're right. And this is actually the second time we've had a CFPB case at the Supreme Court. This is a Fifth Circuit ruling that in some ways came out of nowhere. This was not like an argument people have been raising for years. But the Fifth Circuit said there's a constitutional provision that says you can't spend money without a congressional appropriation. And the way CFPB is set up, it gets its money from the Federal Reserve. It's not subject to the year-to-year congressional appropriation process. And the Fifth Circuit said, that's unconstitutional the way it's set up. And it struck down this payday lending rule that never actually took effect, but it cast a cloud over basically everything the CFPB had done, because if everything it's been doing all this time has been using money that it wasn't supposed to have, maybe there are questions about whether those past actions can stand. So there's a lot of concern, and there's a brief by like the mortgage industry saying, hey, we're really concerned that this might unsettle the mortgage industry if the Supreme Court adopts in a full-throated way what the Fifth Circuit did. So big stakes for this agency. This is an agency that has been very active in a lot of fronts, both the banking world and the non-banking world. So the business community is going to be watching this one very closely.
You know, I do wonder too, Greg, I think about our audience, right? And obviously Supreme Court justices can, Supreme Court decisions, will impact different parts of the U.S. population. But I think about the investment world and the business world, and I think about certainly the CFPB, they're going to be following that. But what do you think is top of mind for like the Bloomberg audience?
Certainly, all these cases about regulatory agencies are really, really important. And the business community kind of has an ambivalent relationship with them. Hmm. So they don't like a lot of the regulation, but they do like stability. And the CFPB case sort of threatens some of that stability. There's another big case involving it's a little technical, but really, really important, but about how much authority agencies have to interpret ambiguous federal statutes. And that's another case where if you give the agency more power, which is traditionally what they've had, that at least ensures some stability in terms of the regulations. So that is a big thing. So far this term, we don't have any of the major business fights, nothing over like punitive damages or class action, none of the kind of traditional fights that the Chamber of Commerce has been pushing. The biggest action is probably going to be in these administrative law questions.
Which also raises the interesting observation, I suppose, that, I mean, of all the courts that you could bring some of these conversations to, this Supreme Court is one that has been you know, willing to wade into controversies before that prior Supreme Courts have not. So what's the current kind of chatter about why they picked what they picked and the, you know, the read of the Supreme Court on these particular cases?
So what's interesting about this term is that a lot of these cases, the ones we've been talking about, were kind of ones the Supreme Court didn't have any choice but to hear. Traditionally, if a lower court strikes down a federal statute, blocks a regulation, and if the Solicitor General, who's the top government Supreme Court lawyer, asks the Supreme Court to hear an appeal, the Supreme Court almost always will. And that is, there are a number of cases, both granted already and cases that probably will be granted soon, where that's what's going on. Where so it's less the case so far this term that we can say, oh, the Supreme Court is really interested in affirmative action and, you know, may want to consider outlawing affirmative action like we had last term, or overturning the constitutional right to abortion like we had the term before. There are fewer cases like that and more cases where a court like the Fifth Circuit is saying, hey, Supreme Court, do you want to go this far? And the Supreme Court is sort of forced to grapple with whether it really does.
Hey, one thing I wanted to ask you, the Fifth Circuit and then the Supreme Court picking up these cases, not all of them go the way of the conservatives, right? We've seen that in the past.
Yes, that is absolutely the case, Carol. Last term, for example, the Fifth Circuit lost at least a significant amount of the case. The Supreme Court reversed the Fifth Circuit in significant part in 7 of the 9 cases they have. So that court's not been doing all that well lately, and it is very much an open question. I'm sure the Supreme Court, I think highly likely the Supreme Court, will uphold the Fifth Circuit in some of these cases, but probably not all of them, and, you know, which ones, very hard to say.
The story that we're discussing, the Supreme Court has a pile of cases from conservative Fifth Circuit, is in the upcoming issue of Business Week magazines, but you can read it now on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com. Hey, we're talking with Greg Storr, Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter. Greg, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you right now about the news today from Justice Clarence Thomas, who's issued a rare recusal in January 6th Trump lawyer appeal. What's going on here?
Yeah, so Justice Thomas did not give us any explanation for this recusal. So to some degree, you know, all we can do is speculate. But I'll tell you what the case is about. It is this lawyer, John Eastman, a law professor who has been a lawyer for Trump, advising him on the election issues. He is one of the people who's under indictment in Georgia in that case. And this was a case involving the House committee looking into the January 6th attack, trying to get access to his emails. The Supreme Court turned away John Eastman's petition today, and Clarence Thomas, without any explanation, said, I'm recusing myself. I'm not taking part in this case. So this is the first time in a January 6th related case that he has recused. What exactly the reason is, there was a report in Politico about a year ago that indicated that some of these emails that we're talking about referenced Justice Thomas and had John Eastman saying, he is our best hope for overturning the election results. And so that might be what it is, that Justice Thomas is aware of that there's substance, you know, he's in there substantively. It may be something else. Again, the justices are required to, although some justices do give an explanation as to why they recuse. He did not.
Interesting times we are living, no doubt about it. Guys, thank you so much. Greg Storr, Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter. His story is in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands later on this week. Find it online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg. And if I can just give a little shout out, his wife, Kimberly Atkins Storr, on a podcast called Sisters in Law. I love it. It's
goes you inside. Told me about that podcast.
Oh, I love it. I'm obsessed with it. And also,
I didn't know
of course,
we had a connection to it. That's cool.
I didn't know initially, and then I'm like, but it's really fun. They just go through all of the legal cases. And of course, our thanks to the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, joining us from Bloomberg headquarters. Yeah, it's a great podcast. It's four prominent lawyers, all women, sisters in law, but they're all involved in the legal universe and just what's ever front and center. A lot of it has been on Trump cases, as you would imagine, as we talked about earlier, but just goes in and out of different things. They've talked on things with legal issues with Elon Musk and Tesla.
Maybe they should come on the show.
I would love. It's really, really fun and kind of a must listen, just like we are. This is Bloomberg Radio.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us. You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Can I just say, I cannot believe it's October already?
I didn't even realize it. It snuck up on me.
I mean,
we got to buy our plane tickets.
I haven't done that.
That's what makes me think of. And I'm not talking for Thanksgiving or, you know, Christmas holiday.
No,
I'm talking like we got a trip coming up
next week,
and we don't have tickets yet. So that's how it snuck up on me.
All right, a lot of things sneaking up on us, including earnings just a couple of weeks away. Let's get to our next guest. She's Senior VP and Lisa Erickson is also head of the Public Markets Group over at U.S. Bank Wealth Management. She's on Zoom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It is nice to have you back with us, Lisa. This market environment, the fourth quarter, what are you thinking might ultimately be the major themes, or is it hard to kind of figure that out right now?
Well, we're going into this fourth quarter a little bit cautious. And the reason why is when you look at the balance of risk and reward, what you really see is pretty even stack on both sides. Certainly on the positive side, we've had corporate earnings remain relatively resilient and beating expectations for most of the year. In addition, the consumer really has held in there with their spending despite multiple headwinds. And certainly when we look at monetary policy, we're certainly closer to the end of a hiking cycle, although the exact end is yet to be unknown. But on the other hand, when we just look at overall economic activity, it certainly is slowing, and not just here in the U.S. And again, as we talk about monetary policy, it's unclear how long higher for longer is going to last. So that really leads us more at a neutral position, just recommending that clients would stay at their strategic weight, whatever that typically would be.
So does that mean a recession is coming? A recession is imminent? What does that mean?
Well, right now, our U.S. bank economics team really is on the soft landing side of it, although, again, the chances are pretty near 50-50. And the reason why, again, is if you look at the underlying driver of the U.S. economy, the consumer, they have really hung in there in terms of being able to continue to spend both on experiences and goods. But again, we've got that continued challenge where inflation hasn't come all the way down. And as a result, the Federal Reserve is still keeping that tighter monetary policy.
How much risk are investors at this point, especially if ultimately we are going to continue to take out key levels when it comes to the Treasury trade and yields in particular? You know, 10-year yields, we talk 5%. That's the easy part. 6%, 7% that people have floated around. That's a different environment.
To your point, Carol, that really is what's keeping us, again, on the more cautious side of neutral. And it's really the fact that you've had this relentless rise in Treasury yields, both on the back of what's going on with Federal Reserve policy, but also simply because investors are concerned. It's kind of a good news is bad news scenario. As we continue to get some nice economic readings, they're just concerned, again, what that means for rates staying higher. And eventually that does have to impact the consumer.
When do you think it starts to actually impact the consumer? Because you did say that, you know, the consumer has hung in there. the consumer has hung in there for quite a while, but you know, gas prices are going up. We got oil prices going up.
We've talked about household balance sheets for
household balance sheets are done with that excess cash, except for the wealthiest mm-hmm. of people. And then, of course, you have the auto worker strike as well. And then student loan repayments starting up again for, 45 million Americans?
Well, really, that's our big question, Tim, is really how long can that consumer continue to spend at the levels they have been? And all the signs are pointing to those headwinds that you've talked about continuing on through the fourth quarter. And so really, it's that rate of change game between, again, how quickly can some of those inflation pressures come down? Hopefully we get some, you know, eventual relief on the rate front, besides the fact that, you know, they are being able to consumer-wise continue to hang in there with some of the excess savings that they still had from the pandemic spending, as well as the fact that the labor market is still relatively strong. And so that really is some of the key data that we're going to be looking at as we continue to move into this fourth quarter.
All right. So big macro talk. We've got your macro perspective. What does it mean in terms of what investors should do either on the equity side of things or on the fixed income side of things on a day where we see the Russell, which is a great indicator of kind of our local and U.S. domestic economy, goes negative for the year?
We are really recommending that clients right now stay neutral on the big asset classes. So again, whatever would their typical long-term...
So you still have exposure. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, go ahead.
Correct. So whatever their typical long-term weight would be on an asset allocation basis to equities, fixed income, and real assets, that they just stay at that weight as opposed to overweighting or underweighting while we continue to monitor the data. Now, certainly within those markets, there may be some areas where you can skew to and for, but within the U.S. equity market, we really just believe having that broader exposure at this point certainly just makes sense, again, at whatever your long-term weight would be.
Hmm. Okay.
So does that mean more interest in the market-weighted performers, or how do you see that?
Well, right now, we just recommend broader exposure to the market, but certainly for clients who have a shorter term time horizon in terms of any liquidity or current investment objectives, our favoritism within the U.S. equity market actually would be to some of those sectors that offer above average dividend growth and yields. And really the reason why is, again, with some of this uncertainty in the economy right now,
right,
and the potential volatility that we've seen, having that income cushion, we think, really makes a difference.
You're the second person since I did a show earlier on Bloomberg Radio and on our YouTube channel with Bailey Lipschultz, second person, Tim, who talked about dividends and looking at dividend paying stocks in this environment.
Well, is that where we are in the cycle, Lisa?
Well, certainly we think, again, with the lack of clarity, having that cash in hand certainly is attractive. Now, for clients with longer term horizons, we do see some opportunity, again, in those secular growth sectors. There's a lot of ongoing trends towards AI, machine learning, just use of the cloud, anytime, anywhere spending that should benefit those companies. But again, given the run-up that they've had really over the last few months, and as well as the fact that their valuations are relatively more rich, we would advise looking for those on a longer term basis.
All right, we're going to run. Hey, listen, thanks so much. Lisa Erickson, Senior VP and Head of the Public Markets Group over at U.S. Bank Wealth Management on Zoom in Minneapolis.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.